garbage filmmaker with his head so far up his own ass, he can taste colon. Radio Drone. Welcome to another episode of Radiodrome. I am Josh Hadley. With me, as always, is the Canadian monkey man, the Peter.
I wasn't ready for that. It came at me too early.
Too bad. Deal with it. Because the Cecil is back this week, so people might actually listen to the show again.
I am very surprised to hear that. You guys should listen to the show. If I'm not here, it's still good. It's just,
though, welcome back, man. We did miss you. I missed your voice. I missed you in general. You're fucking awesome. I'm glad you're feeling a bit better.
Your sweet, loving embrace was missed.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm getting there. The show must go on, as they say.
Good, man.
Well, you could always order something from adamandeve.com to help you a little bit. Adamandeve.com. So you guys go there, you use the promo code DROME, D-R-O-M-E, and you will get 50% off of a single item, 3 free DVDs, a free sex swing, and free U.S. shipping. All you have to do is use the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. And also, you need a VPN, especially we're going to be talking about movies again. That's what we kind of do here. And sometimes these are movies not available on any kind of streaming service. You have to go to the dark side of the net. And that's when you need a VPN, a virtual private network. So you go to 1201beyond.com/DROMEVPN. That'll bring you over to Nord's site, NordVPN, where you'll be able to, through our link, get 75% off of a 3-year plan. That's $3.79 a month for Nord's protection, where they'll encode your data, they'll protect your data, you'll be able to get around region locking, you'll be able to say you're from wherever you want. It's really useful in this day and age. 1201beyond.com/DROMEVPN. So Cecil, with you being back this week, I did hold this topic because I knew it's one you'd want to talk about. And it's just strange that last week, Peter and I talked about, with Darren, American Zoetrope, which was heavily involved in the New Hollywood movement. And I didn't even intend this to be the next episode. We're going to talk about New Hollywood 2, when the 1990s started that. And it dovetails very nicely from last week, even though I didn't intend it to. So this is your topic, Cecil. A little bit of background on New Hollywood, just in case you don't know. New Hollywood was basically ushered in 1969 by Easy Rider. It was old Hollywood was on its way out. Musicals and these giant, epic Cleopatra-style pieces, and nobody was going to see these anymore. After Easy Rider came out, it was a new ball game. And this is where it was filmmaker-based. It was vision-based. It wasn't based around the stars. It was based around the story. People ate this up until Francis Ford Coppola destroyed the movement in 1982 with One from the Heart, which was kind of the end of New Hollywood. Now, a lot of people don't call this era New Hollywood 2, but I think it has all the hallmarks of being it, and that's that, remember that 90s indie boom where all of a sudden you got Danny Boyle and Quentin Tarantino and Kevin Smith and Richard Stanley, Jim Jarmusch, Paul Thomas Anderson, Robert Rodriguez, Jeffrey Wright, you had all of these people coming in. It was like New Hollywood all over again, where the indie stuff was the stuff that was making the money. You guys remember this?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when it all started happening, a lot of it was revolving around Sundance, where Sundance was really, I don't know if it was for the first time or for the first time that you got the general audiences to pay attention. It was like, hey, there's all this really great stuff coming out of Sundance. You know, there's Kevin Smith, there's Tarantino, there's Greg Araki, Richard Linklater. There's all these people that are making these smaller films that are so much better than the drivel that was being dripped into theaters. It was exciting. It was new. It was different. It was when I really sat up and paid attention and, you know, immediately fell in love with Kevin Smith, who became one of my biggest influences. he was making, I think more so him, but a lot of the people, they were making the films that they wanted to make on a very small budget. And it was coming out and being much more interesting and better because it was all about the story and it wasn't about the spectacle.
Well, it was a very different time. It was a changing time also with filmmakers. Like, we started seeing a lot of very different people coming into the fold. Film festival times were getting a lot more different, particularly with like seeing people like Kevin Smith and seeing people like this showing up at Sundance, and film was evolving. And it really was, I would call it a very interesting time. We were seeing a lot of very different stuff. We were seeing film evolving. We were seeing changes being made to the industry at large. And I would call it very exciting.
And see, there were a couple of different things that were happening all at the same time that I think caused New Hollywood 2 to happen. One of those things was the VHS boom, because obviously that was big in the 80s as people got more and more VCRs, things of that nature. By the early 1990s, a VCR was just a standard object in your home. Everybody had these. Everybody had a VCR. Video store culture, Blockbuster is getting huge. Everybody's going to rent a movie. Some of the studio stuff was still on that 9 to 12 month cycle. You know, it's not coming out on video until it's been off theaters for a year, because they were still trying to protect their TV sales. Well, a lot of these New Hollywood 2 movies, these were never going to play on TV. They might play on cable, but they're not going to play on TV. So people were renting these like mad, and that's where word of mouth spread. Because like in the first New Hollywood movement, word of mouth would spread through the drive-ins and through the cinemas. Yes. This was spreading through the video stores. And you had all of these magazines. Like, in a way, I'll call this also the Film Threat era. This is where Film Threat was super powerful. When you read about one of these movies in Film Threat, you immediately tried to go and find the VHS of it. Sometimes you could.
It felt big. Seeing an article from them, it was like, this felt legit.
Film Threat was how I found out about the Fantastic Four Roger Corman film.
Yeah,
and I remember that cover.
I was at a comic book convention, and of course, the old comic book conventions used to sell a lot of bootlegs, and I bought a copy of a bootleg of it for $20, and I loved it, you know, for as terrible as it was, but...
Still the best Fantastic Four movie that's come out so far.
I have to agree.
In this era, you've got VHS being a giant. You have cable channels starting up like Sundance and IFC that are focusing on this. Because what's different about this era than the New Hollywood 1 is the New Hollywood 1 was an independent voice and style in the studio system. Because almost all those old movies after Easy Rider from New Hollywood 1 were by Warner Brothers and Fox and Universal and places like that. It was the studios are learning, we need to let the filmmakers just make their films. By the 90s, that wasn't a thing anymore. Bulk of these were independent studios and independent filmmakers that were making more money and getting more word of mouth than all of the big budget Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone and Steven Seagal movies that were coming out from the studios. It was sort of like the studios didn't learn their lesson the first time around that, hey, we should embrace this. Although maybe they eventually did, because almost every single one of the filmmakers that came up during this era ended up being a studio filmmaker, just not from the New Hollywood 2 era.
Downside to all this, what really is sad, because you had people eschewing the major studios and looking more into the independent guys, unfortunately gave rise to Miramax, and in that we got Harvey Weinstein out of it.
I was gonna say cutting the shit out of everything.
We do have to talk about Weinstein, because Miramax is a giant player in this era.
At this point, in the early to mid 90s, he was ripping through everything.
So much good independent people got their start distributed through Miramax, but he ended up just being just such an awful human being and taking advantage of a lot of the people that worked with him, and just taking advantage of his position of power that he
just
gained.
Decimating a lot of these films. He's done awful things, obviously, to actresses, and he's been like this very rapey guy, but it's like, even before that, even before these accusations, like, he was notorious for just ruining movies.
Harvey Scissorhands.
The one thing I will point out is the bulk of the Miramax films that came out in this era were Disney films. Disney bought the company in 1993. What a lot of people forget about with Reservoir Dogs, The Crow, Pulp Fiction, Clerks, Heavenly Creatures, Four Rooms, Kids, Hardcore Logo, Sling Blade, those are all Disney films because Miramax was owned by Disney at that point.
It is funny, this kind of ties in with that, but when Kevin Smith was looking to do Dogma, Miramax wouldn't release it because it was tied to Disney. So that's why he went and put it out under Lionsgate. And it's just funny that they released Kids because nobody knew. But then when they found out that they were a subsidiary of Disney, they wouldn't release Dogma because it was too religious.
The New Hollywood 2 movement, it technically would have two different beginnings depending on where your criteria lands. Now, a lot of people who, like I said, nobody except me really calls this New Hollywood 2, but I see the similarities with New Hollywood, and I think it's unavoidable. Right. A lot of people say that this era of the independent film boom all goes back to Woody Allen working within the studio system. And I disagree with that. Leaving all the weird sex fetish stuff out from Woody Allen, I can't stand this man's films. And I don't see what some of these other people are seeing. Because some of the critics say that this era owes so much to Woody Allen because most of the movies from the New Hollywood 2 era are dialogue-based, they're character-based, there's less plot, it's more dialogue. Have you guys ever heard that old saying within Hollywood, if this scene doesn't advance the plot or deepen the characters, then it doesn't need to be here. It's an extraneous scene. Most of these movies are all extraneous scenes, like Clerks. That entire film is all scenes that would have been cut out of a different film, that would have been deleted scenes. And that's
great, just fantastic scenes in
right,
Clerks.
So
much great dialogue there.
That's where the audience had shifted. They'd shifted away from Arnold Schwarzenegger in Eraser and the Antonio Banderas movies, and they were wanting more character-based movies and dialogue-based
movies. Remember when Antonio Banderas was like a big thing?
The kind of thing is, that's why people are saying that Woody Allen is the grandfather of this era, and I totally disagree with that. I don't think...
Well, definitely a grandfather of fucking kids that are too young for him.
There's that.
I see what they mean, but he's not like the only one he's the one that kind of made that popular at the time, but there are plenty of other directors that did that.
And I'm not saying it just because it's where this show gets its namesake. Look at something like Videodrome. That is an absolute independent film made for freaking Universal. You know, someone like Cronenberg would be
like
the grandfather of this, I think.
Of Cronenberg's films were very independent, though, if you think about it. If you look at all of his movies.
But they were all studio
films.
Only
for me to segue into my joke of, now for a joke, I'm a neurotic nerd who likes to sleep with little girls.
Hey, that sucked, McBain.
What I think is the true beginning of New Hollywood 2, we think of it as a 90s thing, and it really is. But I think the true beginning is 1989, Miramax, Sex, Lies, and Videotape. The movie is all character. It's all dialogue or the sex scenes. That, to me, and that film broke huge. That movie only cost like $1 million, and it made like $100 million at the theatrical distribution. Sex, Lies, and Videotape, I think, is where New Hollywood 2 truly started.
Yeah, I could see that. It definitely had everybody stand up and pay attention because it's like, hey, there's this movie that kind of came out of nowhere and all of a sudden blew up. And really, it's very dialogue driven. It was unlike a lot of other stuff that was out at the time. And it got people to watch things that were a little bit different. We were kind of getting a lot of the same stuff. I would say, in a way, we're really overdue for a New Hollywood 3.
I was about
to
say, New Hollywood, the trilogy?
I don't know if it's going to happen, though, right now, because there are two...
It almost happened, I feel like, because we had directors like Refn. We had movies like... was that one Gyllenhaal did? Nightcrawler, the journalist, videographer that was, like, staging crime scene accidents to look a certain way and stuff. Like, I think we almost had a New Hollywood 3 with directors like Nicholas Refn, with the guy who did that. Movies like that, like, we almost had this very artistic, independent directorial style for New Hollywood 3, and then it just kind of died out.
And then Disney stepped in again.
Yeah, Disney stepped in, and Marvel stepped in, and it's like, we had all these great movies that were coming out. The Carl Urban Dread, which was just awesome. Marvel and Disney, they had their merger. They bought out 20th Century Fox. I think nowadays it's like it's impossible for that to happen at this point because it's so corporate now.
Well,
the distribution model has changed because when New Hollywood 2 happened, like I said, it was the video stores, and you still had the era of the independent video store. You had the independent film magazines that were talking about this. Now, where are you going to go? The streaming services? Well, those are all corporate owned. With New Hollywood 2, you had certain filmmakers who were really known for this era. It's hard to describe if you didn't grow up during this era, but all of these films, they had a certain feel to them. Even if you go back and watch some of these today, you're like, this feels, and I don't mean just like based on hairstyles and stuff, this feels so 1994 independent cinema kind of thing. Because you had certain filmmakers, like obviously Tarantino has a style all to his own. Someone like Jim Jarmusch being able to make Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, that feels so 90s, but not in a negative way. You've got Paul Thomas Anderson with Hard Eight and Boogie Nights. Again, not in a negative way. They feel so 90s. A movie like Sling Blade, there's no way a studio would make a fantastic film like Sling Blade. You've got
Reckon
Richard.
Would you like to eat in there?
You've got Richard Stanley's two Miramax films. Okay, you know, obviously Dust Devil, we didn't see till years later. The correct version.
They were cut to shit. Obviously, like Richard Stanley was not a man for the studios.
But then there's also, and now I hate this movie, and I'm sick of people trying to elevate it to some sort of a level of genius, but a movie like Kids could only have come out during this era in 1995.
You both of you keep mentioning this fucking Kids movie.
I don't remember. You've never seen Kids was...
It's garbage. Pure trash.
I don't hate it, but it's not the kind of movie that you're like, hey, I want to sit down and enjoy a movie. It's like,
I really don't remember it at all. The one I remember is Jack with Robin Williams. I like that.
Oh God. No. This is Kids. What it was. It was who is the director? Larry Clark. He's notorious for filming kids doing. His one movie is banned in the U.S. because it actually didn't have like penetration in it or something.
Oh my God!
It's a story. It's shot almost kind of documentary about these two kids that are going around. They're doing drugs. They're all like 13. Like it opens up.
You just said the fucking age. It sounds like that movie 13.
Right. It's 13 was done awful. 13 was done a little bit more like a movie. This is done a little bit more like documentary. In 13, there were consequences with 13. Whereas this, it's just here's these kids. They're being awful people at the end. Like the one kid finds out, like this girl goes to the doctor and she finds out that she has AIDS, and she's trying to tell this guy that she has AIDS, that he needs to go get checked. And then she gets drugged and raped. And like, it's kind of a story of a bunch of kids that are just doing drugs and having sex. And it's very uncomfortable.
Well, it sounds like they were attempting to do like a Euro film, but they didn't really know what they were doing.
For some reason, people elevate this movie to some kind of a genius cinema, and it's like, no,
complete crap.
The movie is pure and utter garbage. It's the same thing with, I guess I can see why people like this man's movies. I personally think he's one of the worst filmmakers that's ever made a film, and that's Greg Araki. I think the man is a complete incompetent hack, and The Doom Generation is one of the worst films, not of just the 1990s, of all time. But I can see why people would gravitate to someone like Greg Araki. I just think he's garbage filmmaker with his head so far up his own ass, he can taste colon.
Right.
I don't know. I think Nowhere is fantastic. Nowhere is...
He's obviously just... had his ups and downs. I don't think he's that bad. I don't think he's...
Yeah, he's Nowhere. He's not like, God, like the guy who did the last Die Hard movie.
Oh,
who, like,
fuck.
Every movie he's done has been a gigantic pile of garbage.
Is that Paul Greengrass? Like,
no, that wasn't... Oh, Paul Greengrass is... No, he's the shaky cam guy who I can't stand,
oh, okay.
Who also
oh,
stinks.
Oh, God.
John Moore, every movie he's done stinks. He kept getting... He did the remake of The Omen. He did the Max Payne movie. He did...
just like very bland kind of stuff.
Very flat.
Real interest.
They're just bad movies. And
yeah.
He kept getting bigger and bigger movies. And I didn't understand it because each one was terrible. But no, like, he's somebody who stinks. I'm fine with Greg Araki. Like, I'm not going to go out of my way. With the exception of Nowhere, I'll watch Nowhere because that movie is just crazy. And you know, it's a spectacle to be seen. I'm not going to go out of my way to watch the Doom Generation and stuff. He's doing his own thing, and he's doing these very small films. He's not making a giant $200 million tentpole production, which, like, I have a little bit more to say about that. When you're a terrible director that's making a giant budget film and you stink, I don't understand that. But here's a guy who's making these small films for small studios, and I don't really see, you know, he's making a film. Obviously, somebody wants to see it, or he wouldn't have a career, you know?
Right.
Like Richard Linklater, I think, is another one who he's making these very small personal films that now he's way, like, I think he's light years beyond Greg Araki. I mean, I love his stuff.
Yes.
But also, look at something like The Crying Game. The Crying Game comes out. It's one of the biggest films of 1992. And nobody saw this movie coming.
I can't help but laugh because, like, that whole movie was a punchline for Ace Ventura.
That whole movie was a punchline for a lot of things, but yeah, that was a big...
The Crying Game is one of those kinds of movies that kind of comes out of nowhere and was a slap to Hollywood. No Hollywood studio was going to make a movie like The Crying Game. It wasn't good, though.
If we're really being real, that movie sucked.
Kind of liked it. I thought it was a pretty decent film. Now, I saw Jay Davidson
really,
was clear. Jay Davidson was clearly a man the whole time, but...
It was ham-fisted. They wanted you to be pissed off at the fact that, like, there was a transvestite, and there was a dude with a dick, and the guy beats her. Like, I really think they were, like, trying to pull in the shock gasp kind of crowd with that movie. I don't think it was good. I honestly think that was a shit film.
The really weirdo movies that no Hollywood studio would touch. Lance Mungaya's Six String Samurai, which I think is one of the best late 80s movies ever made.
So good.
Really?
No studio was ever going to make Six String Samurai.
Fantastic.
No, but that was kind of the beauty of it, is I love a lot of the movies that no studio would make because they're not focus tested. Here's a guy who had a vision. He made a movie about a guy who was traveling to Las Vegas because, you know, Elvis...
Post-apocalyptic
Elvis, who was running things, that died, and they were all fighting to be the new king of Las Vegas. And it's just, it's so unique. It's just well done. And yeah, it's another, like, if they did it, they would have, like, more sword fights and CG, and there
would be Arnold in the main role.
Yeah, you know, it wouldn't work, but it works because it's this little, you know, the dude kind of looks like Buddy Holly,
which is intentional.
Which I know was intentional, but I'm saying, you know, he's not the person you would expect to be doing this. And it's such a unique, different movie. I like that. That's one thing that I think is missing nowadays, where we're not getting these risky films. At least we're not getting them out of the U.S. Or if we do get them, they're really bad. Like,
we're not getting a lot of unironic stuff. And this is something that I felt when I was watching. I didn't get to see it live. But Joe Bob's Drive-In with Deadbeat at Dawn. And I was like, that's one of my favorite movies ever. I love that film. There's so many unironic moments in that. It's like he's doing nunchucks in a graveyard and throwing stars at like ninja stars at a tree and shit. And it's like, there's no comedy to that. He's just doing it for the sake of, like, being a badass. And it's like, there's no punchline. There's no jokes. We need more of that. We need more of just, like, film a scene for the sake of the importance of it. You don't need to make a joke. If it ends up being funny, it might be funny. You don't need to have this insecurity of chucklehead fucking humor directly in front of the camera. Just film it. Just do it. Just film the scene.
There's also something where, even in this same era where you've got Tarantino and Kevin Smith, and you got Peter Jackson making Heavenly Creatures and that, you also have this weird... Now, I love this movie, but this is kind of an outlier in the New Hollywood 2 movement, and that's The Crow. And I don't mean this in a demeaning way. It feels more like a studio film. It doesn't feel as like an indie film as all of the other things Miramax was putting out at the time. And I don't want to go into too much detail on everything that happened with The Crow, because I do want to do a Crow retrospective soon. But
right.
That movie doesn't feel like it should fit in with this, but it does. Does that make sense?
I don't know. I disagree with you. I think it has a style that was very different that the studios then co-opted. We got movies later that were studio productions that were trying to be The Crow, but The Crow was really the one that did that. So I think now, maybe looking at it in hindsight, you know, you could be seeing all the stuff that came because of that. But really, there wasn't anything. That's one of the Crow, sadly, was huge for two reasons. Number one, it was sad because it got all the recognition because Brandon Lee died. And it also got the recognition because it was such a breath of fresh air. It was so different from all the other things that were out at the time. So I think that those were the things that really made it blow up. And then the studio movies, you know, they saw that and then they just made their versions.
I don't know how I feel about this, because I love the film, but I also see why no studio would touch it. At the same time, you were on your sabbatical, Cecil, but Peter and I talked about what an absolute garbage person Abel Ferrara is. Something like Bad Lieutenant, the 1992 film, and I'm only talking the uncut one. That R-rated cut is unwatchable because half the freaking movie's gone.
But I mean, it's one of Keitel's greatest performances.
Oh, it's great. Bad Lieutenant is amazing. Like, that performance is, it's unlimited. It's top tier. Like, God,
I honestly,
he really, like, he took that.
He went all in on it.
He took that performance to the mountain. It was great.
I'm not sure, because I agree with you. I agree with you, Peter. Keitel is amazing in that. The fact that Christopher Walken turned down that role 2 weeks before filming, after deciding that he wasn't right for the part, I wonder
if...
He's still
the King of New York, though.
But I just wonder if Walken would have made that movie better or worse.
No, I don't think so. I think Keitel was perfect for that. Particularly that, because there's the naked scene where he's like doing crack or heroin or whatever, where he
trips down
and everything. I think Keitel was the perfect demeanor for Bad Lieutenant. I don't think anybody could have made that role better. And then for King of New York, that was more Walken's film. Like, that was perfect for him as far as the scenes that had to happen for that movie was just absolutely brilliant for him to do. And then Keitel with the, it was like, guys, cock.
I kind of look at it from the perspective of, now this happened a little bit differently, but what happened with Back to the Future, where Eric Stoltz came on board and they realized he was wrong and he left. And then they got Michael J. Fox, who was...
They filmed like half the movie with Stoltz.
Because you wonder how it would have... Now, that's a case of where you wonder how it would have been, but then you actually were able to see some of the scenes and you're like, yeah, it doesn't work with Stoltz, but it totally works with Michael J. Fox. That's not saying that that Stoltz is a bad actor. Stoltz is a very good actor, but he just wasn't right for that part. And the same thing with this, where I think that Walken is great, but he would not have delivered the right performance for this.
Well, like, there's something about Keitel. There's like a certain tough guy aspect. There's a certain like playing a rough and tough, hooked on drugs cop.
He also gives He gives a real vulnerability to the lieutenant too.
He does. There's something that really works about Keitel in that movie. And like, even just now, picturing as like hard as I can with like all of my brain capacity, which there's not a lot of it left because of all the liquor, I'm trying to think of like how Walken would fit into that movie. Doesn't work.
But, you know, Walken thought that too, because he had the role, and then he was just right before filming, he was like, Abel, I don't think I can do this.
That's because Walken's an intelligent, like, smart fucking guy. Like, he knows what works and what doesn't. He really does. I love him as a filmmaker. I really do. But holy Christ, when you hear him in interviews, when you hear him talk about stuff, it's like, guy's got a lot of problems.
He's a garbage person as a person.
He's got issues, man. He really does.
I mean, like, if you remember from that,
he's like, God, he really is one of those dudes. He could really bring out the inner grime, the inner seediness of New York City. And it was so great to see it in a lot of his movies, like, you know, as far as The Driller Killer goes, even movies like Fear City. God, his movies look so good. There's just something off about him. And it's like, you can tell because of that reputation, he never made it to the top tier of people like Martin Scorsese. And it's not because of the quality of his films, because of the quality of his personality. Honestly, it's because of who he was. It's because of the shit he said on talk shows. The guy was trouble to work with, unfortunately. And that's just, oh, Jesus, it sucks because I love his movies so much, but he really does just seem like, just an asshole.
Okay, to describe Ferrara's style, a pretentious film critic once wrote, this was about Driller Killer, "The Driller Killer is almost a very definition of sleaze. Few films are able to radiate such intensity solely on their visuals. You can almost feel the dirt and grime of the streets and clubs in the images themselves, drenched in darkness with a wet sheen to everything, and you can very nearly smell the stale urine and dried sex in every frame of film." And I was that film critic. I wrote that. that was in my piece for Night Flight on Driller Killer. But am I wrong?
No, it's a shame. There are a lot of I don't know that much about him personally, but it is always a shame when you see someone who like, they have talent and then you find out that they just suck.
I don't consider this part of New Hollywood, although it would be part of this movement, but we're coming from, like, film school in Canada, something like Cube in 97. It fits into this era, but it's obviously
Cube
not Hollywood,
great.
And Cube is
Cube
a great
is
movie.
Such a
Cube is,
movie. God,
it's brilliant.
Too
it really
bad Zero
smart.
And Two blow ass, but that's a different discussion.
Well, that was... Suck. They wanted, you know, I mean, you can't, there are certain things that you can follow up on. Like, there's, you really, like, you can't recapture that, you know? It's like trying to do the same thing again. You can't.
I mean,
it was too different.
The movie where it's like the opening scene is a guy that goes through like a laser grid thing that cuts him just into like chicken meat. It's like, then we go on from the story. And these people trying to get through level to level, like, it was the prototype for movies like Saw, and it did it so much better.
I'm not going to consider New Hollywood 2, because, like, that was literally a student film from Canada. So it's not the same kind of mentality of a Tarantino, a Kevin Smith, a Billy Bob Thornton, that kind of thing. But I do want to talk about one of probably the greatest filmmakers that came out of this era. People know his name, but they forget he was part of New Hollywood 2, because everyone knows Kevin Smith, Quentin Tarantino,
yes.
Paul Thomas Anderson.
Well, yeah, of course.
Danny Boyle. There was Robert Rodriguez. Now, I wouldn't say El Mariachi was part of this. That sort of predates it, and that is a true, just, you know, film by the seat of your pants kind of thing. Rodriguez, when, you know, Desperado, and then
well,
From Dusk Till Dawn.
He got Desperado because of El Mariachi.
Right,
well, yeah.
But I'm just saying El Mariachi,
that's
I don't consider...
Got him, that's what got him noticed.
But I would even call From Dusk Till Dawn a kind of New Hollywood film, really.
Yeah, because it was a small production. Like, people don't realize George Clooney was like nobody really.
Oh no, he was actually pretty huge from ER. This
was still the ER.
Did ER start?
ER had been out for about 4 years, and that's actually where Tarantino had met him, because
Tarantino
had directed an ER episode. That's how they became friends, and he talked him into doing From Dusk Till Dawn. So ER is directly responsible for this.
He would not. He
wasn't
been a leading man.
Yeah, he wasn't a movie star. He was a TV star.
That's kind of what I'm saying.
Been like, the leading man that he is today, if not for Rodriguez and Tarantino. Like, I think they really helped him get that push.
But he wasn't, that's the thing, he wasn't like, you know, the leading man yet. He was like, because there was still at the time in the 90s, there was still a very definite difference between you were a TV star, you were a movie star.
Yes.
Like there weren't, like if you were a movie star and then you start doing television, that's like a step down. But
yes.
Now, if you're
it was
a movie
like,
star,
it was like tarnishing your reputation, pretty much.
Right. It's like, oh God, he must be doing really bad if he's doing television.
Yes.
But now there's not really that distinction anymore. A lot of times, if you are what's his name, Bryan Cranston, who was in Breaking Bad, like he got huge amounts of respect for that, and then was able to kind of go back and forth and do movies and television, whereas that wasn't really a thing. It was back in the 90s, you did one or the other, or if you were successful enough, you could do a David Caruso and go from television to movies. But if you were a failure, you were seen as a failure if you went from movies and went back to television.
Mel Gibson had that quote back from the 90s. When a movie actor does television, it proves they weren't good enough to be in the movies. You know, like television had this sort of stigma of, well, that's the junior league.
Well, at the time it was true because there were limitations on television. Like now that we've got like HBO and all the other ones that are basically making these movie quality television shows, I never really watched it, but Game of Thrones, like that sort of stuff, you know, on par movie level quality as far as like writing and
well, back
effect,
then the TV show didn't stuff. Cost $100 million a season,
but that's what I'm saying. So back then, if you went back to do, you know, if you were in movies, then you went back to doing television, well, that's why it was seen as such a negative. But now it's, you know, television is as big, if not bigger, than movies, because of the fact that, you know, you're going to have people talking about these shows going on for look at something stupid like, well, I mean, this is a benefit of the time, but like Tiger King, like everybody's trapped indoors, so they're watching Tiger King. And that guy,
show about scumbags, essentially. You got people that are like glorifying
a show about awful people.
They're all awful criminals, just fucking terrible, awful people.
But then somebody like Robert Rodriguez, and if you've ever watched on the DVDs, they always have his 10-minute film school segments. This is a guy who didn't think like a normal, even an independent filmmaker. Because you have Tarantino, who is going to set up a shot in a certain way. You have Kevin Smith, who's going to set up a shot in a certain way. You have Richard Stanley, who's going to set up a shot in a certain way. You have Robert Rodriguez come in going, nah, we can do this way more efficient. He was sort of a real breath of fresh air, I think.
Well, I think all the guys you mentioned there, they all had their own ways of doing things, except maybe besides Kevin Smith. Like, he never considered himself a director, but if you do look at Stanley and all these other people in comparison to Rodriguez, they were all very salt of their own earth. There was a very difference in a lot of...
They have their style.
Yes, they
did. They have their style, but they're still shooting things in a relatively conventional way. Well, we need the setup, we need the over the shoulder. Whereas Rodriguez would come in and be like, okay, I want this shot. Now stop your dialogue. And just right in the middle of the scene, I'm going to move over here, because in his head, he was editing the movie. So he was able to be like, we don't need these extra setups because I know exactly what I want.
He really had an incredible aesthetic to him. But I'm just saying that of the guys you mentioned, like, you know, Richard Stanley was like that, too. Like a lot of these other directors that you're mentioning, very much in the same sort of capacity. And it's so great that Rodriguez made it into the Hollywood fold and was able to make all these big movies, because a lot of these other directors, they deserve that push too. You know, Stanley,
Stanley
Kevin Smith, not so much, because like he really didn't have that much of a notable style, but it's like Stanley absolutely deserved to be in the Hollywood fold. Even guys like Jim Van Bever, who was friends with Stanley, and it's like, but Rodriguez ended up in that fold. He ended up becoming one of these big directors, and he really did have, as you said, like a lot of those unconventional directing styles, and it's so awesome.
He was a maverick at a time.
Yes, he was.
There weren't any mavericks. They were still kind of following a certain thing, and he had his own vision. Like, when you look at his stuff, especially his earlier stuff, it has a very, very distinct style that is very Rodriguez.
Oh, without a doubt.
Because he had so much control. I mean, if you watch, like, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, it opens up with produced, edited, directed,
cinematographer,
like
everything.
Like, he had his fingers in every single aspect of the production. And a lot of people, like, they don't do that. They'll rely, and I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just that that lends so much more to his particular vision that it's all coming back to him.
Well, yeah, he had this style that was all his own, and a lot of stuff that he was doing just on his own by himself, directing, producing, writing, staging the shots, doing like all this shit, and it was so good. Like, he was fantastic.
But then I want to talk about one last filmmaker here who I think kind of comes out of New Hollywood but absolutely does not, and that is, it's a foreign filmmaker whose style and films were only discovered on a mainstream level because of New Hollywood 2, and that's John Woo. I think no, seriously, hear me out here. Okay, he'd been making the films in Hong Kong, and they had limited distribution over here. Every now and then, maybe you'd see one. I mean, like, I remember when Joe Bob showed A Better Tomorrow and The Killer on drive-in theater once. So occasionally, you'd see a John Woo movie on pay cable, and that's it. I think if it wasn't for Tarantino and Rodriguez and Stanley and Smith, those John Woo movies coming over here on VHS, it really fits the aesthetic of New Hollywood 2, even though it's literally not Hollywood. It's freaking Hong Kong.
I had to, I forget who was talking. It might have been Tarantino. He was talking about John Woo. And I actually I paid $40 to import The Killer. You know, you're not going to go to Blockbuster and be able to rent that. So I paid to import it, and it was awesome. It was amazing. Now, granted, I had already seen Not a Better Tomorrow.
Hard Boiled.
I had already seen Hard Boiled and loved it, but The Killer wasn't anywhere. So I had to import it. And it just had a very distinct, unique style that was unlike everything that else out there as far as action films.
Do you agree with me that the aesthetic of those John Woo movies coming over to America absolutely fit into New Hollywood too?
It did, and it influenced, because then how many people ripped off that style?
Well, John Woo, I believe, shaped the action industry, not only what it became in the late 90s and early 2000s, but what it is now, that very like raw, yet at the same time, very choreographed, in your face kind of style. John Woo really shaped what we're seeing right now in action at large. Like, that guy deserves a shitload of credit.
But then I guess the final question about New Hollywood 2 is, obviously, all these movements within filmmaking end at some point. I don't think New Hollywood 2 had a definite, well, that's over with, like the first New Hollywood did with One from the Heart was, yeah, we're done. That's the end of this thing. I don't think this one so much had a definite end as it just sort of petered out, for the reason almost every single one of the filmmakers who came up in New Hollywood, even foreigners like John Woo, ended up going to mainstream Hollywood, and then they started making 15, 20, 30, 40, $50 million films. In a way, Hollywood swallowed up this movement just as it did in the first case.
And it did.
What does that say, that you have all these literal independent voices who, with the exception of maybe Richard Stanley, are all studio filmmakers now? They're all contracted to Warner Brothers or Disney or Fox or something like that. What does that say about a movement like New Hollywood 2?
Well, it just shows that they made their way up the ladder. And in some cases, it was not a good thing because obviously they were stripped of a lot of their creative liberties. It shows that they succeeded. It shows that John Woo succeeded. It shows that a lot of these other directors did as well. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. It shows that they had success in what they did. But it's just the entertainment industry. When something is hot, when the pulse of something is scorching hot and the studios see it, they pick it up, they pluck it up, they throw it in, and force feed it to the audience. That's just what happens. Sometimes it's not the best. It's not the best finale for a director, but it's like, obviously, yeah, I'm sure John Woo is not complaining about the fact that he's getting paid a lot more nowadays. And, you know, he got to do one of the Mission Impossible movies and stuff like that. But at the same time, does strip the filmmaker of a lot of their, what originally got them put on the map, which is a lot of their original creativities, which is what these studios tend to do, is they tend to strip them down to the bone and tell them what they can or can't do. And that is what seems to happen as far as a situation such as this.
Well, you also have the aspect that Hollywood, especially with someone like John Woo, they were afraid. We don't know if this guy can handle a studio film. Remember, that's why Sam Raimi was the backup director on Hard Target, because the studio was like, we don't know if this John Woo guy can do it, so Sam, you vouched for him. If he screws it up, you're taking over this production. That's why Sam Raimi is sort of the understudy on Hard Target, because the studio, they didn't know if John Woo could do a studio film. Because when you look at something like The Faculty, I don't see, you can like the movie all you want. I don't see Rodriguez in that at all. I see not a single Rodriguez touch in that. The Faculty feels like a studio film. It feels like studio filmmaker could have made this movie.
Yeah, but Robert Patrick as a Cthulhu is so good.
But
so,
what I'm saying is that I think that the majority, like some of them were lucky enough that they kind of got pulled into the system and are now making whatever they want. You've got Tarantino making whatever he wants. You got Rodriguez, who I think is still kind of doing whatever he wants. But then you've got Sam Raimi, who wasn't part of that, but I think he kind of, like, he came before that, but he kind of got sucked up into this. And
kinda
I really
grandfathered in.
Grandfathered in, yeah, but it's like, I feel this, like, I still love Sam Raimi, but I mean, if you look at something like The Evil Dead, and then you look at Oz, it's like, what are you doing? Like, why?
But Cecil, that I agree with that. But at the same time, but while the whole New Hollywood 2 thing is happening, Sam Raimi's making Darkman. You know, that's not really the same kind of movie, is it?
No, but that has his style all over.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it doesn't have his style, but it also has a very studio style to it as well. It doesn't feel like it would fit into New Hollywood because it wasn't. So
right. It's polished in his particular style, though. Like, if you look at it, like, if you watch Darkman and then watch something like the any of the Marvel films, it is so, it's like, okay, it does feel like a different animal.
What do you think was the long-term fallout of New Hollywood 2? Do you think that this is something that really changed everything? Or, like New Hollywood 1, really changed everything for a little while? Because it seems like any time we have one of these things, mainstream Hollywood swallows it up, sanitizes it, throws it through a blandotron, and just spits it back out. Do you think it really made a difference? Or it only gave us some great filmmakers down the line?
What happens with every generation, not a lot really changed. Every generation of filmmaking, you've got like your art films, you got your blockbuster films, you got your like mid-range films. It's not so much what we see nowadays, obviously, with the lack of the video stores. There's not a lot of middle ground, middle class filmmaking. It's mainly just big and low class. I just think it's something, it's a very pendulum shifting. Nowadays, I think things are a lot more nihilistic at this point. People are willing to either be super supportive of something or be super cynical of something, but I really just see it as Hollywood is Hollywood. They're going to do what they're going to do. They're going to make what they're going to make, whether you like it or not, and you've always got the choice of independent cinema, which nowadays is actually really booming. Like, we've actually got a lot of really great horror films coming out of the indies. We got a lot of great action films coming out of the indies. Like, if you don't like what Hollywood is doing, you do have a choice. You do have an option to go somewhere else and focus on something else. And I'm not sure where I'm going with this rant, but it's like, it's kind of what I feel like and what I've felt like for the last probably 10 or 15 years, is that you don't need to rely on Hollywood to get the types of films that you want to see. There are a lot of ventures out there that are doing some far superior stuff that you could check out, that you could be checking out, that Hollywood isn't tackling.
We did get a lot of good that came out of this. Like, it gave a lot of very talented actor directors their future. They were able to kind of continue doing what they loved. But unfortunately, Hollywood, as they usually tend to do, they took a lot of this and just absorbed it. They didn't really learn from it. They just said, oh, okay, well, this is a commodity that we can buy up. They, you know, bought up a bunch of the directors and whatnot and just told them to do their style for them instead of doing it independently. And then things went back to normal, I think, or should say normal for the studios. So I think that it was good and it lasted for a little while, but it kind of petered out because they weren't really giving them a lot of the leverage that they had while they were working on Independence. You had some that were able to continue to make what they wanted, but then you have others that just got absorbed, and it's a shame. So I would love for there to be another break, because I think we're really overdue for it, because right now it's getting increasingly bland at the movies. Like 2019, I was depressed. 2018, really, I'm sorry. 2018, with just how much mediocrity was out there, these gigantic movies that made $1 billion that were completely forgettable. And I'm all for a big, entertaining film. Like, if something is big and dumb and explodey and, like, fun, but there are a lot of movies that are that, but you still remember them. And right now, we're getting a lot of films that are just these big, giant spectacles that they don't leave you with any value. You just instantly forget about them. And the Marvel films. But yeah, like, I think we're in the era of I kind of coined this. I think I coined this, but the disposable blockbuster. We get these movies like the Lion King or the Aladdin remake. They come along, they make $1 billion, and then a week later no one's talking about
them. No one gives a shit. No one remembers.
Yeah, no one remembers. Nobody cares. Yeah, it's just, it's there, it makes a lot of money, and then nothing. You know, we used to have times where we would have a movie would come along, would make a shit ton of money, and would kind of enter the cultural zeitgeist. You get people making memes and jokes and quotes and spoofs and everything, and now it's just kind of there, makes a lot of money, and then gone.
And there's one other aspect of the new Hollywood, too, that we didn't really touch on. How the established indies were not part of this. You didn't see any trauma movies from the new Hollywood 2. No Full Moon movies from the new Hollywood 2. Isn't it kind of weird that the established indies were the ones who also were afraid of any kind of change or anything different? Whether we get a new Hollywood 3 or not is debatable, because I don't know if with the streaming distribution model, I don't know if a film on Hulu or on Tubi or on Netflix could really be this kind of thing. Guys, I want to know what you think of the new Hollywood 2 movement, or whether we were just sucking our own dicks for the last hour. So on that note, where can people contact the Cecil now that he's back on the interwebs?
If you want to send me some nice heartwarming messages, I am over at goodbadflix.com, as well as GoodBadFlix on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Facebook, and 1201beyond.com.
And Peter, where can people contact the Drunken Canadian?
Find me at Zinematica at Twitter, yelling at the sky. No longer Facebook. I deactivated my Facebook account other than Messenger. So you can find me at Patreon at Zinematica and YouTube, The Cinemasochist.
And you can contact me at 1201beyond@gmail.com. And remember, 1201beyond.com. Guys, try to be a cut above. Keep one foot in the gutter, one fist in the gold. Have a good night. Thank you.
Radiodrome is a 1201 Beyond production. Find it and other great content at 1201beyond.com.